Welcome back, everybody. It's Under the Radar, a Rolling Stones podcast about deep cuts and hot cookies. I'm Tim Lindsay.
And I'm Christian Bonner.
We're recording this in two very different environments. I'm in a very big echoey room, so this is possibly going to be a little weird, but we'll do our best. Christian's back up at Shatterhand Sound in North Toronto. And
yeah.
How's the weather up there?
It's extremely snowy. We've had a blizzard here for the last few days.
Yeah, we had planned to get together and record this in person, but the weather gods intervened. Anyway, the main focus I think we're going to talk about today is the Rolling Stones Voodoo Lounge Uncut Blu-ray and live album. It literally is the full uncut show. This is an epic recording, originally pay-per-view in 1994.
Then a terrible VHS.
Yeah, the DVD and VHS version. I did force myself to sit through the entire DVD just so I could compare what had changed in terms of camera edits.
Well, in turn, there's one very memorable camera edit that I noticed because I was 14 when this came out, and there was brief nudity that has been removed from the official release, I assume for legal liability reasons.
Well, I caught that. Yeah, I think a lot of these DVDs have to obviously go through some kind of ratings board process for wide release in the European Union. I don't know if nudity specifically is off the list, but it certainly couldn't help. But the song that you're talking about that's in, I did notice that's in Honky Tonk Women at the end.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Mick has a bit of banter at the end about what a nice group.
Hello, Mom.
Or something to that effect. And it's a joke that sort of falls flat if you don't realize that somebody just flashed him a minute before.
Yeah, presumably the reason is that concert DVDs were not subject to rating in the 90s, and that was straight off the broadcast feed. And if you're a camera person at a live event, you're obviously going to go for the in-the-moment stuff.
Yes.
Yeah, no, and I assume that they cut it simply because they didn't, whether or not they had to submit it for ratings, I'm sure they just didn't want to bother.
Well, and the other thing that they cut out of that song entirely is the film footage that they show, like stock footage of women behind the stage.
I do remember that, of the old horror movies.
Yeah, and there's one title card of a movie called The Voodoo Woman. So presumably that was the thematic tie-in there, but maybe they just couldn't get the clearance for those old clips.
They may have used it illegally and not cleared it. You know, I don't know why, but that actually makes perfect sense.
So, you know, if you're a collector now, you have to have both the original DVD and this new one, if just for that reason.
Well, it's already very, very expensive. The DVD editions of both the 90s concert ones are very expensive. Now, I don't think anyone will actually pay that for it, but you only ever see them on eBay or Amazon for $200 to $300.
Yeah, I can only tell you that if you want to hear the crowd at like nightmarishly loud levels all the way through in the audio mix, the original DVD is for you.
No, the mix on the VHS, I never had the DVD, but the mix on the VHS is unbelievably terrible.
Yeah, there's missed mic cues.
Yeah, there's really nothing redeeming about it. In some ways, it's kind of bad because you can actually hear what a mess the beginning of Who Do You Love is.
Right.
You just couldn't tell that Keith's playing in the wrong key.
Yeah.
Very blatantly. Go song by song, or are we just we'll be here all day probably.
This is a long show. Let's put it that way. We have talked before about the basic structure of the Voodoo Lounge concerts, how Satisfaction comes at a weird time and everything like that. But, you know, apart from Chuck Lavelle and maybe occasionally Andy Snitzer on second keyboard, there's not a lot of extra ornamentation. The horns are only out when they absolutely need to be.
For some people, that's going to be a good thing. Yeah. I know that there's a lot of people who object to the level of backing musicians. We at Under the Radar here are very much in favor of Bernard and Lisa and the Woodford horns or whatever they're called.
Yeah, they're called the New West horns here. I don't know what the hell is going on with
probably
that.
Probably just a copyright thing. We like that, the horn line in Miss You.
Right. Well, it comes in right at the end there, the final go round.
Well, it's good to give it something to introduce a new element that late in, you know, a very old, there used to be an email newsletter and I can't believe this is the first time I'm bringing this up here. There used to be an email newsletter called the Sticky Fingers Journal. And if anyone else remembers that, give us a like and subscribe.
Yeah.
There was one person there who made a very interesting point that Miss You and Out of Control were the Midnight Rambler and You Can't Always Get What You Want of the 90s, that they were the sort of long stretch out jam pieces.
Yeah, and that's true, yeah. You get Ronnie and Bobby Keys doing their cool little duet on the top of the riser there.
Yeah, he always seems to run up there and tell Bobby, oh, play a really high note or do a thing that I can ham up.
Yeah.
You know, now I had a weird experience, and obviously I wasn't alive in the 70s, but what I found really interesting about watching this is that I really find that if you look at the Bridges to Babylon tour on, there's a certain cohesion to the direction of the show, and the presentation is much slicker than in almost any tour before. And somehow, I feel that the Voodoo Lounge tour has more in common with the tours of the 70s than you would normally expect. And certainly, there's pre-recorded cues, and there's wireless mics, and there's all these things that nobody was doing in the 70s. But in terms of the kind of, you know, like Mick goes, oh, somebody's got to clean up the stage, it might as well be me kind of thing. And
yeah,
it's just this, for a long time, it was the highest grossing tour of all time, but it still kind of had this,
a little bit of a ramshackleness.
Ramshackle intimacy, yeah. You know. And I don't know if anyone's going to agree with me on this particular point, but, you know, I guess it comes out because, you know, Voodoo Lounge is you know, maybe the first neoclassical Rolling Stones album, and that it, you know, the big criticism at the time being, oh, they made Exile on Main Street again. So then the logical thing to do is to intersperse things like Rocks Off and Sweet Virginia.
Yeah, Monkey Man.
The new Monkey Man, and that was Lisa's showcase piece for a long time. I was talking to someone, you know, and realized that more time has passed between, say, the 1972 tour and Voodoo Lounge. More time has now passed between Voodoo Lounge and that, you know, and it'll only get further and further away. You know, I recently blew my own mind realizing that, you know, there's only really 11 years between 1969 and 1980. So, you know, I grew up in a world that was closer to a lot of that than people born in the 90s or anyone born after, you know, the Berlin Wall came down, and it all kind of is starting to blur together. So to me, it had a real look of a classic, you know, Rolling Stones adventure. And yes, there's the big scorpion tail that shoots fire, which is, you know, obviously amazing.
And those massive grid of lighting fixtures sort of stretching off into the sky behind them, which they do a really cool kind of video feedback thing for Sparks Will Fly, where that sort of seems to zoom out into the infinity on the big screen behind them. Sparks will fly. Sparks will fly. Hey! Come on!
And there's really something about those Mark Fisher sets that I've really been... As much as we do like the later set designs, the Mark Fisher designs will always be my favorite to me. And yes, I know full well that's because that's when I grew up, but iconic to me to remember this. You know, but this is, we're definitely getting into the period where, like, I remember there was a Pepsi ad around this time where an ant drinks some Pepsi and then he turns into Mick Jagger and starts singing Brown Sugar.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
The Microsoft Windows 95 ad, and, you know, we're very much at the point, I remember the Love is Strong video was on all the time, we're very much at the point where
media saturation, yes. We are so mesmerized,
all this inside. There are some really standout performances, I would say, here. Rocks Off is definitely one of them. It's it's one of the tightest performances. Like, okay, fine, Mick got one of the verses out of order, but who cares, really?
Yeah.
When the phaser kicks on in the Beast of Burden solo, woo!
Yeah.
It's It's like the helicopter at the beginning of Apocalypse Now. It's just, you know, blows you back in your seat. Three standout performances, I would say, on the other side of that, that the acoustic mini set doesn't really come off right. I think there was a monitoring problem, and there's obviously a reason why they didn't ever do that again.
I feel like they focused in better for the stripped shows, and that's kind of why it's interesting to compare this directly with the Tokyo Dome show from 95. It was right around that time. It was actually in Tokyo where they recorded a lot of those sort of new arrangements of old songs.
We might as well, as everything we get, nearly everything we ask for on this show, that we really want the full Toshiba EMI sessions released. Yeah.
I half expected that that would come with the Voodoo Tokyo, but I guess not.
Well, but that's what I expected from Totally Stripped. You know, it's right. Now, I'm not going to sue anybody for false advertising, but if you call it Totally Stripped and you leave out a bunch of material there, like that, we know that there's an acoustic Beast of Burden. We know that there's an acoustic Let's Spend the Night Together.
Oh, yeah.
We know there's an acoustic, well, not that it needed to be acoustic, but there's a No Expectations from that era. There's what used to be known in the bootlegs as the Stripped Companion. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they just assumed that that was good enough, but just give that a proper mix and put it out.
Yeah, and it was on camera too, right? So we could have the whole thing on video, presumably, as long as camera is rolling. And I think Keith even did stuff from Talk Is Cheap record in those sessions.
Yeah,
so.
We hear that there is a version of Make No Mistake, and that's obviously very exciting to think of. And, you know, these are the sessions that gave us The Spider and the Fly and Love in Vain and Little Baby and all that stuff that ended up on the studio portion of Stripped. Mm-hmm. That is as worthy as it's so fantastic to have footage of what I think is probably the best version of Dead Flowers ever recorded. And a lot of the other live stuff, even if there are overdubs or deletions of certain wandering Ronnie moments.
Yeah.
You know, it's wonderful to have that footage, but the Toshiba EMI stuff would be fantastic. But I just don't. There's also something we should discuss, and that is that the stereo mixes of this all seem to be folded down from the surround. And I've noticed on all the stereo mixes, you get a weird kind of gross comb filtering on the crowd noise.
Right. And I think that could have just been as simple as somebody didn't time align the microphone properly for the furthest back crowd. Like there's a bit of a delay with one or two of the microphones. And then when you fold those in together, you get a comb filter effect.
But so then beyond that, there's something extremely weird going on in Sympathy for the Devil, where it sounds like it's almost the surround mics from another song.
Right.
So there's some kind of error here.
Now, this is Sam Wheat. Who'd mixed that? It's not Bob Clearmountain. So I don't know what's going on with the workflow here. I mean, presumably we saw for the Totally Stripped box set that somebody at Apogee did a custom transfer from the original ADATs to high-res multitrack. So presumably they did the same thing here, but maybe even, you know, as far back as that process, something got combined by mistake that unfortunately left it impossible to mix out. I don't know. I don't want to speculate too much, but
we're obviously big dorks and we can get pretty close, but I would say that similar to No Security, while we're talking about who mixed it, I really am a big fan of Sam Wheat's mixes. I'm one of the biggest fans of Bob Clearmountain that there's ever been, maybe, but you know, I know his style very well, and there's something kind of a little bit more fresh and exciting about Sam Wheat and the way he presents this stuff.
If you're not listening to those few moments like in between songs when the crowd noise is really hot, you don't really notice any problem at all. And I do really like the way the drums and the guitars kind of stand out without being too overwhelming.
it's a great way to mix a band like the Stones. Like whenever you hear, sometimes if you're watching on YouTube or something like that, and it's a bootleg to begin with, it always kind of ends up that one element ends up standing out too much.
Yeah.
And with the exception of maybe, you know, the kick and snare or something like that, it always ruins a band like the Stones because it's so necessary to hear the interplay and the push and pull. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if you mixed it like modern pop music where it's really all around the vocal, that would be a disaster, yeah, if you ask me. And you really have to just let it be what it is, mm-hmm, instead of trying to like aggressively, you know, sample, replace, or edit, or tune, or whatever. That's never the right thing to do with music like this, I think.
Yeah, and there's, you know, now that you have, if you know, you're a super, super collector, and you have the original DVD of this, or you have like a dub off of the original pay-per-view broadcast, you can compare it now, apples to apples, with this mix. And there's even, just specifically for the track I Go Wild, there's a Bob Clearmountain mix on the CD single of that song from this show. It's the same take. So you could really sort of get a lesson in how to and how not to mix the exact same performance from the exact same microphones. Three very different sounding mixes there.
That's always a very good exercise, because if you're watching a mix tutorial, for one thing, a lot of mix tutorials are just simply advertising,
right,
you know, snuck in there. But, you know, it's so dependent on the source material.
Yeah.
Not that we're doing an engineering podcast, but
if you're into the stuff that we're into, this is like an instructive way to approach this, I would say.
Yeah.
Other stuff we want to note that's notable about this? I guess there's the guest appearances.
We'd never seen the Sheryl Crow one.
Yeah.
And it's funny that they cut that and not the wobbly Bo Diddley. I mean, it's great to see Bo Diddley. Mm-hmm. I'm not disappointed by that. There's a certain degree to which I like to hear the Stones really kind of mess up a performance, because it just exposes the raw groove elements, mm-hmm, in such a way. And I don't think everybody is into this as much as I am, but it's a very interesting thing to hear them. The groove is kind of balanced right at the point where it's about to fall apart. And so it's kind of interesting to hear it go too far.
Yeah, then you can hear it get put back together as well, like how they sort of lock in and how quickly it happens.
Yeah, and then the Robert Cray stop breaking down is pretty cool, because as you may or may not know, on the studio version, Keith isn't on it.
Mm-hmm.
So what I find interesting about this is hearing, rather than mix impression of the way Keith played guitar in the early 70s, you're hearing Keith's version of the closer to the Robert Johnson way. And there's something, he plays through guitars with P90 pickups quite a lot.
Yeah.
And there's something really interesting about the way that his rig with those guitars, the Les Paul Jr., which he's really started to favor much more again. That it has this sort of snap and decay that you'd expect from an acoustic guitar, but with the, you know, kind of searing sustain for the bends and slurs. So it's a very interesting tone for me to hear. It's obviously a good kind of grouping of Robert Cray, who doesn't ever seem to release his own music, but only guest appears on other people's things,
right,
or tour festivals. I mean, he's still out there, and you got to respect that. He's a more unusual blues player, I find, and his singing is really good on this.
Yeah, him and Mick as a pairing for trading verses, it actually works really well here, and that's not always the case for guest appearances.
No, and speaking of which, one of the things that I do find a bit weird about the Sheryl Crow appearance is that they kind of do it the opposite of the way, you know, you hear them do with Christina Aguilera or anybody, mm-hmm, else, where Mick sings the first verse. They either interchange they either split it up half and half, or it's one verse, then another verse, then, you know. And so it's kind of odd to have her say the "Don't you think we need a woman's touch" line.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It, obviously, there's a million ways to do it, but it definitely seems a bit sideways to me. But she does a good job, and you know, it's a good performance.
You know, obviously she's on the Live Licks version of Honky Tonk Women from Madison Square Garden. I think she's been back since for the 50 and Counting shows. Forgetting where exactly or what they did, but
I think she and Keith are actually fairly close.
Yeah.
Probably through Eric Clapton, if I'm not mistaken. She's on Unplugged,
right,
along with many other of my favorite musicians, Chuck O'Vell and everybody.
Sure.
So,
quickly, well, we should say that, you know, Keith's set here is a little bit unusual. He does Before They Make Me Run and The Worst from Voodoo Lounge, which is good. I mean, I like that rendition of that song.
It's definitely better to listen to this because he looks like a cat that someone is in the process of bathing, and it really kind of takes you out of it.
Yeah.
I find. But both good performances.
You trust me too much. Take all the pay, it's yours anyway. Get out, kid.
And The Worst is one that he kind of neglected for a while and then came back to on the Bigger Bang tour, which is kind of odd because he had two songs on the Bigger Bang that were both quite good and didn't really played one of them too much,
yeah,
and the other one not enough.
It's amazing to me how Chuck Lavelle gets his B3 to sound exactly like an accordion. I don't know what stop he's pulling, but that's a neat trick.
Well, that's apparently his big skill,
yeah,
according to Keith, was stop bar settings and his ability to conjure up these other tones. But that's the original, you know, if you look on a church organ, it has these levers for trumpets or for choir or whatever. It's kind of the original MIDI sequencing. So,
yeah, just talk to John Paul Jones.
Yeah, well, he would know.
So, yeah, like you mentioned, Monkey Man is quite good because that's a big feature for Lisa. They would either alternate that or Gimme Shelter at these tours, which is strange to think about now since Gimme Shelter is such a staple, but there you have it.
Well, that's definitely one of the things that's happened is that a lot of the songs that were kind of occasional rarities have become like you're not going to see them now without them playing Midnight Rambler and Gimme Shelter. I remember at the Bigger Bang show in Toronto, the stadium show, not the club show, hearing Midnight Rambler there and to have them not do it on the B stage, I was really surprised by it. And it was pretty good. Now, since we've seen them three times on the 50 and Counting Zip Code on Fire tour.
Four times, if you count the 2012, 2013 and the Quebec show, yeah.
I totally forgot about the one in Quebec. So yeah, it has been four times. We got Midnight Rambler, Gimme Shelter every single time.
Yeah.
So they've really found this. I still find it funny that you leave every show and somebody's always like, oh, that's pretty good. I just wish they would stop playing their new songs. It's like they played two songs that are new. I always imagine there was somebody saying that in 72.
Yeah, yeah.
If you look at the first four songs in that set, they're all brand new.
Well, and in 78, they did a very ballsy thing by playing about half of Some Girls all back to back to back to back in the middle of the set. You know, again, it was a popular record, and I guess people knew it at the time, but it's very strange to imagine something like that happening today.
Yeah, I don't think that you've really seen that. I mean, the last time they came anywhere near that was the Bridges of Avalon tour.
Right.
Because a Bigger Bang, you know, the single got banned and Streets of Love kind of performed rather tepidly as a single. And, you know, it's just not the same market of radio play and all this anymore. And it's, you know, you'd think that would actually favor them. You know, and if you look at a model like the Eagles, where it's kind of the never-ending hell freezes over tour, we're not even going to make new records.
Right.
And if we do, they're all kind of crowdfunded and sold by an infomercial or, you know, whatever it was.
Yeah.
But
it must be tough being a legacy rock act now just to know that, you know, radio won't play anything except what you did, you know, 40 years ago.
You know, you've got to take the good with the bad. That's constant advertising for yourself. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, like legacy rock acts of that generation are about the only thing that's a draw.
Sure.
And, you know, I think the only place left to go is to do what they want and what keeps them happy. And, you know, who cares what the music press or anybody thinks. That's what I prefer from them and from most artists, I should say.
So we'll wrap this up pretty soon. I think we should talk about the Jersey Show bonus tracks really briefly. But let me ask you this first. Bookending the show, you've got Whoopi Goldberg coming out to introduce the band and then coming back. Well, she sings back up with Corey Glover from Living Color on Sweet Virginia, but she comes back right at the end of the show to sing Jumpin' Jack Flash.
Well, that's her song, obviously.
Yes, from the movie, yeah.
A film that was definitely made.
Yeah, it certainly exists.
Well, that record, there are very few covers of Rolling Stone songs that I actually think are worth your time. Mm-hmm. And I got to give it to the Aretha Jumping Jack Flash. And actually, I think the whole rest of the album that ended up on is pretty cool.
Yeah.
Some people are not okay with 80s production value, but actually I find a good vinyl rip will take most of the sting out of it. Mm-hmm. But you know, that Linda Ronstadt's Tumbling Dice and honorable mention to Little Richard's Brown Sugar. And you know, those are about the ones that the Townes Van Zandt Dead Flowers, you know, there's a handful of ones that are decent and very few people can really capture that energy. But
right.
No, I think she obviously came out on that because it's a branding, just like the, unnecessary name dropping of Planet Hollywood at the beginning.
With the t-shirt as well. Yeah. Things were different in the 90s. You know, media savviness was not necessarily the universal quality that it is today.
It's very much the last gasp of like, you're going to go out and buy this thing because I told you to.
Yeah. We have an ironic distance from that now, but it's funny to think back on what passed.
Yeah. Unless you went to the Fire Festival.
Right.
Yeah, we're totally getting off track now.
Yeah, well, we should quickly mention the bonus content there you've got.
Yeah, I Can't Get Next to You.
Yeah.
Totally worth it.
Yeah, great.
Yeah, Out of Tears, which is good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you really hear how great Chuck is at leading the band and keeping the tempo going in a sort of ballad style. You know, you've got a really excellent choice of keyboard patch from Andy Snitzer for the strings. I know it was 1994 and synth string sounds were not great, but considering that, it's pretty good.
Is there another bonus track?
Yeah, Keith's Happy, which just what we needed, another version of Happy.
Yeah, I know. It's like I was just asking for that.
And also Shattered, which sounds great. I mean, yeah, these versions are really tight. The audio quality is a little bit less than the main show. I don't know if they fully remixed it or what.
Yeah, but. And I think that they only had the broadcast cameras mm-hmm. for that because it's a significant reduction in quality. The only other thing worth mentioning is I did spring for the vinyl for this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, how's the vinyl quality compared with the digital?
I really like it. Obviously, I go on about vinyl quite a lot. You do have that rather annoying fold-down issue. But once you're into the songs, it's not really an issue. It's a good pressing. They don't go too close to the label. It's mm-hmm. split out over three discs. I really like these mixes. I regret not getting the San Jose 99 one.
Well, that's still out there in stores. I've seen a couple copies. Even the color vinyl version of that is still out there in the wild. So if you want it, you should jump on it.
Yes. The obvious downside of something like this on vinyl is that you will be getting up to switch it over a bunch of times. But if you're like me, I've conceded to ripping everything so that I can, you know, not have to get up and to reduce the amount of wear on it. Mm-hmm. But it's a really high quality pressing. The mix translates really well. I don't presume I understand what they did technically to it, but there's a really nice boom and breath to the kick drum, and you know, Daryl's bass sounds fantastic. Mm-hmm. And You know, the guitars are a bit wobbly at times. I mean, it is definitely the Rolling Stones mixed really on it. And there's a nice balance between the instruments. Some drummers may be upset that the cymbal volume is not particularly high. The rest of us will be thankful for that, obviously. And
yeah, the whole thing. I mean, if you just adjust your treble up or down to your preference here, I feel like it's going to withstand your preference, either up or down. And
yeah.
That's a good sign of a mix because, you know, different people have different tastes, but as long as one element isn't sticking out too harshly, if you adjust to your preference, then everything's pretty well balanced.
It's a high quality thing. And I'd like to just add one more thing that I went out and got this at Sunrise Records, which I was pretty sure didn't exist, but I was happy to realize they are still in business in Toronto. They're kind of out in the middle of nowhere, but they have everything you could want when it comes to collector's editions, any kind of physical media. If they don't have it in stock immediately, I mean, they had the 81 to every From the Vault that's ever been released. They had there. And they had the whole box set and everything. And it was good because they had it in the day. And I chose between this and the 50th anniversary Beggar's Banquet. And actually, the Voodoo Lounge one was cheaper than the Beggar's Banquet, which was obviously extremely disappointing.
Well, I mean, this is definitely better value for money. I mean, you know, you're getting 27 songs plus the bonus songs. And
I mean, three discs versus one in a flexi disc in a mono. It's just, and especially, I mean, it's not worth it at any price for me. And
and everything's on streaming now anyway. Like, if you don't want to pay anybody any money at physical stores, you are free to go on streaming services. Yeah. And, you know, the good news is these days that we have access to everything. Like, it's all out there now in digital. So you can really, like, get a good feeling for how something sounds first before you fork down your $50 or whatever it is for the big physical product. You can get a sense of what it's going to sound like. And, you know, on Tidal with master quality, you can even sometimes, you know, surpass what the physical format is capable of, depending on how good your home setup is.
Yes, yes. And I'm only taking slight issue with the fact that the selection is a little bit limited. And I know full well that that's not at all the fault of the streaming services. It's the fault of the band. And they should know by now that we as Rolling Stones fans as a group are willing to pay for things. And
sometimes many, many times over.
Sometimes too much. Yes, of course. I mean, there's three copies of Exile on Main Street in my house right now. I think the lifetime total is probably closer to five or seven.
Yeah.
You know, I have a problem. granted, one of them I dropped the needle on for about 10 seconds before I put it away and never to be touched again. I think without fail, disparage the 2010 Exile on Main Street on every version of the every episode of this show. So it's probably time to end.
All right. Well, that wraps it up. We've been taking a closer look at Voodoo Lounge Uncut. We should say that we do see your comments and questions on Facebook and on the Rolling Stones podcast at gmail.com address. Keep them coming. We appreciate all your feedback and comments. So please do hit us up on the Facebook there, Under the Radar Rolling Stones podcast, or send an email if you wish to rollingstonespodcast@gmail.com and let us know what you think.
Yes. And I, for the record, I've been Christian Bonner.
And I continue to be Tim Lindsay. I hope you've enjoyed this. Until the next time, we say goodbye.